Chapter 95. The mud and dust which the other vehicles left behind. These equipages adorned the yard of the Hotel Martigny, on the return of the family from their mountain excursion. Other vehicles were there, much company being on the road, from the patched Italian vetture like the body of a swing from an English fair put upon a wooden tray on wheels, and having another wooden tray without wheels put atop of it to the trim English carriage. But there was another adornment of the hotel which Mr. Dorr had not bargained for. Two strange travelers embellished one of his rooms. The innkeeper, hat in hand in the yard, swore to the courier that he was blighted, that he was desolated, that he was profoundly afflicted, that he was the most miserable and unfortunate of beasts, that he had the head of a wooden pig. He ought never to have made the concession, he said, but the very genteel lady had so passionately prayed him for the accommodation of that room to dine in, only for a little half hour, that he had been vanquished. The little half-hour was expired, the lady and gentleman were taking their little dessert and half-cup of coffee, the note was paid, the horses were ordered, they would depart immediately. But, owing to an unhappy destiny and the curse of heaven, they were not yet gone. Nothing could exceed Mr. Dorrit's indignation, as he turned at the foot of the staircase on hearing these apologies. He felt that the family dignity was struck at by an assassin's hand. He had a sense of his dignity, which was of the most exquisite nature. He could detect a design upon it, when nobody else had any perception of the fact. His life was made an agony by the number of fine scalpels that he felt to be incessantly engaged in dissecting his dignity. "Is it possible, sir," apostrophe said Mr. Dorrit, reddening excessively, "that you have had the audacity to place one of my rooms at the disposition of any other person?" Thousands of pardons. It was the host's profound misfortune to have been overcome by that too genteel lady. He besought Monseigneur not to enrage himself. He threw himself on Monseigneur for clemency. If Monseigneur would have the distinguished goodness to occupy the other salon especially reserved for him, for but 5 minutes, all would go well. "No, sir," said Mr. Dorrit. "I will not occupy any salon. I will leave your house without eating or drinking, or setting foot in it. How do you dare to act like this? Who am I, that you separate me from other gentlemen?" Alas! The host called all the universe to witness that Monseigneur was the most amiable of the whole body of nobility, the most important, the most estimable, the most honored. If he separated Monseigneur from others, it was only because he was more distinguished, more cherished, more generous, more renowned. "Don't tell me so, sir," returned Mr. Dorrit, in a mighty heat. "You have affronted me. You have heaped insults upon me. How dare you? Explain yourself." Just heaven, then, how could the host explain himself, when he had nothing more to explain, when he had only to apologize, and confide himself to the so well-known magnanimity of Monseigneur? "I tell you, sir," said Mr. Dorrit, panting with anger, "that you separate me from other gentlemen. That you make distinctions between me and other gentlemen of fortune and station. I demand of you, why? I wish to know on what authority, on whose authority. Reply, sir. Explain. Answer why. Permit the landlord humbly to submit to Monsieur the Courier then, that Monseigneur, ordinarily so gracious, enraged himself without cause. There was no why. Monsieur the Courier would represent to Monseigneur that he deceived himself in suspecting that there was any why, but the why his devoted servant had already had the honor to present to him. The very genteel lady, silence!" cried Mr. Dorrit. "Hold your tongue. I will hear no more of the very genteel lady. I will hear no more of you. Look at this family, my family, a family more genteel than any lady. You have treated this family with disrespect. You have been insolent to this family. I'll ruin you. Send for the horses. pack the carriages. I'll not set foot in this man's house again. ... No one had interfered in the dispute, which was beyond the French colloquial powers of Edward Dorrit Esquire, and scarcely within the province of the ladies. Miss Fanny, however, now supported her father with great bitterness, declaring, in her native tongue, that it was quite clear there was something special in this man's impertinence, and that she considered it important that he should be, by some means, forced to give up his authority for making distinctions between that family and other wealthy families. What the reasons of his presumption could be, she was at a loss to imagine, but reasons he must have, and they ought to be torn from him. All the guides, mule drivers, and idlers in the yard had made themselves parties to the angry conference, and were much impressed by the courier's now bestirring himself to get the carriages out. With the aid of some dozen people to each wheel, this was done at a great cost of noise, and then the loading was proceeded with, pending the arrival of the horses from the post house. But the very genteel lady's English chariot being already horsed, and at the inn door, the landlord had slipped upstairs, to represent his hard case. This was notified to the yard by his now coming down the staircase in attendance on the gentleman and the lady, and by his pointing out the offended majesty of Mr. Dorrit to them with a significant motion of his hand. "Beg your pardon," said the gentleman, detaching himself from the lady, and coming forward. "I am a man of few words, and a bad hand at an explanation, but lady here is extremely anxious that there should be no row. Lady, a mother of mine, in point of fact, wishes me to say that she hopes no row." Mr. Dorrit, still panting under his injury, saluted the gentleman, and saluted the lady, in a distant, final, and invincible manner. "No, but really here, old feller, you..." This was the gentleman's way of appealing to Edward Dorrit Esquire, on whom he pounced as a great and providential relief. "Let you and I try to make this all right. Lady so very much wishes no row." Edward Dorrit Esquire, led a little apart by the button, assumed a diplomatic expression of countenance in replying, "Why, you must confess that when you bespeak a lot of rooms beforehand, and they belong to you, it's not pleasant to find other people in them." No, said the other, "I know it isn't. I admit it. Still, let you and I try to make it all right, and avoid row. The fault is not this chap's at all, but my mother's. Being a remarkably fine woman with no bigot nonsense about her, well educated, too, she was too many for this chap. Regularly pocketed him. If that's the case, Edward Dorrit Esquire began. Assure you upon my soul 'tis the case. Consequently, said the other gentleman, retiring on his main position, "Why, row?" Edmund, said the lady from the doorway, "I hope you have explained, or are explaining, to the satisfaction of this gentleman and his family, that the civil landlord is not to blame." "Assure you, ma'am," returned Edmund, "perfectly paralyzing myself with trying it on." He then looked steadfastly at Edward Dorrit Esquire, for some seconds, and suddenly added, in a burst of confidence, "Old feller, is it all right?" "I don't know, after all," said the lady, gracefully advancing a step or two towards Mr. Dorrit, "but that I had better say myself, at once, that I assured this good man I took all the consequences on myself of occupying one of a stranger's suite of rooms during his absence, for just as much, or as little, time as I could dine in. I had no idea the rightful owner would come back so soon, nor had I any idea that he had come back, or I should have hastened to make restoration of my ill-gotten chamber, and to have offered my explanation and apology. I trust in saying this." For a moment the lady, with a glass at her eye, stood transfixed and speechless before the two Miss Dorrits. At the same moment, Miss Fanny, in the foreground of a grand pictorial composition, performed by the family equipages, and the family servants, held her sister tight under one arm to detain her on the spot, and with the other arm fanned herself with a distinguished air, and negligently surveyed the lady from head to foot. The lady, recovering herself quickly, for it was Mrs. Myrtle, and she was not easily dashed, went on to add, that she trusted in saying this, she apologized for her boldness, and restored this well-behaved landlord to the favor that was so very valuable to him. Mr. Dorrit, on the altar of whose dignity all this was incense, made a gracious reply, and said that his people should hot countermand his horses, and he would overlook what he had at first supposed to be an affront, but now regarded as an honor. Upon this the bosom bent to him, and its owner, with a wonderful command of feature, addressed a winning smile of adieu to the two sisters, as young ladies of fortune in whose favor she was much prepossessed, and whom she had never had the gratification of seeing before. Not so, however, Mr. Sparkler. This gentleman, becoming transfixed at the same moment as his lady mother, could not by any means unfix himself again, but stood stiffly staring at the whole composition with Miss Fanny in the foreground. On his mother saying, "Edmund, we are quite ready, will you give me your arm?" he seemed, by the motion of his lips, to reply with some remark comprehending the form of words in which his shining talents found the most frequent utterance, but he relaxed no muscle. So fixed was his figure, that it would have been matter of some difficulty to bend him sufficiently to get him in the carriage door, if he had not received the timely assistance of a maternal pull from within. He was no sooner within than the pad of the little window in the back of the chariot disappeared, and his eye usurped its place. There it remained as long as so small an object was discernible, and probably much longer, staring as though something inexpressibly surprising should happen to a codfish, like an ill-executed eye in a large locket. This encounter was so highly agreeable to Miss Fanny, and gave her so much to think of with triumph afterwards, that it softened her asperities exceedingly. When the procession was again in motion next day, she occupied her place in it with a new gaiety, and showed such a flow of spirits indeed, that Mrs. General looked rather surprised. Little Dorrit was glad to be found no fault with, and to see that Fanny was pleased. But her part in the procession was a musing part, and a quiet one. Sitting opposite her father in the traveling carriage, and recalling the old Marshalsea room, her present existence was a dream. All that she saw was new and wonderful, but it was not real. It seemed to her as if those visions of mountains and picturesque countries might melt away at any moment, and the carriage, turning some abrupt corner, bring up with a jolt at the old Marshalsea gate. To have no work to do was strange, but not half so strange as having glided into a corner where she had no one to think for, nothing to plan and contrive, no cares of others to load herself with. Strange as that was, it was far stranger yet to find a space between herself and her father, where others occupied themselves in taking care of him, and where she was never expected to be. At first, this was so much more unlike her old experience than even the mountains themselves, that she had been unable to resign herself to it, and had tried to retain her old place about him. But he had spoken to her alone, and had said that people are people in an exalted position, my dear, must scrupulously exact respect from their dependents, and that for her, his daughter, Miss Amy Dorrit, of the sole remaining branch of the Dorrits of Dorsetshire, to be known to him to occupy herself in fulfilling the functions of a valet, would be incompatible with that respect. Therefore, my dear, he laid his parental injunctions upon her, to remember that she was a lady, who had now to conduct herself with him a proper pride, and to preserve the rank of a lady, and consequently he requested her to abstain from doing what would occasion unpleasant and derogatory remarks. She had obeyed without a murmur. Thus it had been brought about that she now sat in her corner of the luxurious carriage with her little patient hands folded before her, quite displaced even from the last point of the old standing ground in life on which her feet had lingered. It was from this position that all she saw appeared unreal. The more surprising the scenes, the more they resembled the unreality of her own inner life as she went through its vacant places all day long. The gorges of the Simplon, its enormous depths and thundering waterfalls, the wonderful road, the points of danger, where a loose wheel or a faltering horse would have been destruction, the descent into Italy, the opening of that beautiful land as the rugged mountain chasm widened, and let them out from a gloomy and dark imprisonment all a dream, only the old mean Marshalsea a reality. Nay, even the old mean Marshalsea was shaken to its foundations when she pictured it without her father. She could scarcely believe that the prisoners were still lingering in the close yard, that the mean rooms were still every one tenanted, and that the turnkey still stood in the lodge letting people in and out, all just as she well knew it to be. With a remembrance of her father's old life in prison hanging about her like the burden of a sorrowful tune, little Dorrit would wake from a dream of her birthplace into a whole day's dream. The painted room in which she awoke, often a humbled state chamber in a dilapidated palace, would begin it, with its wild red autumnal vine leaves overhanging the glass, its orange trees on the cracked white terrace outside the window, a group of monks and peasants in the little street below, misery and magnificence wrestling with each other upon every root of ground in the prospect, no matter how widely diversified, and misery throwing magnificence with the strength of fate. To this would succeed a labyrinth of bare passages and pillared galleries, with the family procession already preparing in the quadrangle below, through the carriages and luggage being brought together by the servants for the day's journey. Then breakfast in another painted chamber, damp, stained, and of desolate proportions. And then the departure, which, to her timidity and sense of not being grand enough for her place in the ceremonies, was always an uneasy thing. For then the courier, who himself would have been a foreign gentleman of high mark in the Marshalsea, would present himself to report that all was ready, and then her father's valet would pompously induct him into his traveling cloak, and then Fanny's maid, and her own maid, who was a weight on little Dorrit's mind absolutely made her cry at first, she knew so little what to do with her, would be in attendance, and then her brother's man would complete his master's equipment. And then her father would give his arm to Mrs. General, and her uncle would give his to her, and, escorted by the landlord and inn servants, they would swoop downstairs. There, a crowd would be collected to see them enter their carriages, which, amidst much bowing, and begging, and prancing, and lashing, and clattering, they would do. And so they would be driven madly through narrow unsavory streets, and jerked out at the town gate. Among the day's unrealities would be roads, where the bright red vines were looped and garlanded together on trees for many miles, woods of olives, white villages and towns on hillsides, lovely without, but frightful in their dirt and poverty within, crosses by the way, deep blue lakes with fairy islands, and clustering boats with awnings of bright colors and sails of beautiful forms, vast piles of building moldering to dust, hanging gardens where the weeds had grown so strong that their stems, like wedges driven home, had split the arch and rent the wall, stone terraced lanes, with the lizards running into and out of every chink, beggars of all sorts everywhere, pitiful, picturesque, hungry, merry, children. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.